die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
To the unknown future. This is Red Ice Radio. For the Seeker.
Think and know the question. I must strive to know.
Greetings, sports fans. No, that's just a joke. I'm just joking. Welcome to everyone listening from around this cuckoo globe, the mental institution of the Milky Way. I'm Henrik. I hope you're well. We are excited to bring you more radio on fascinating topics today. We've got worldwide, wherever internet is available, through our website, redicecreations.com. Also, check out redicemembers.com and redicemobile.com for additional access points to our stuff. Our member section is filled with goodies for you, so check it out if you like what we do. This keeps all of this going, so thank you. Okay, Robert Sullivan is a philosopher, historian, antiquarian, jurist, theologian, writer, and a lawyer. He is the author of The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. It is his first published work, and it's the result of 20 years of research. Today, we're going to talk about the book, of course, and go deeper into Masonic lore and the origins of Masonry. The rituals, ceremonies, names, and deities surrounding the Royal Arch degree is something we'll also discuss. We talk about the history of battling secret societies and philosophies with pro-papal Jesuits and anti-royal aristocratic Masons. We'll also get into Enoch, the Book of Enoch, and Enochian magic. Good stuff, so stay with us. Welcome, Robert. Thank you for coming on the program. First of all, this is going to be very interesting, I think. You have a very interesting book with a lot of material, a lot of stuff in it, so we're looking forward to it. Welcome.
Thank you, Henrik. It's wonderful to be here with you on Red Ice, and looking forward to this interview.
You bet. Now, before we dive into the meat of the book, of course, talking about Enoch and the Royal Arch and everything else, why don't you just tell us about your background a little bit as a Mason and when you first came across some of the material that led you to write this book?
Sure. The journey for me for writing this book began when I was an associate student at Oxford University 20 years ago. I was a graduate. I graduated Gettysburg College, which is in Pennsylvania. I was a history major there. But for my junior year, I studied abroad at Oxford University. And it was really when I got over there that I was sort of exposed to what you would call authors who are writing about the Hermetic tradition coming out of the Renaissance, going into the Enlightenment, sort of these characters. People like, people that you've really never even heard of over here, people like Pico della Mandarola, Marcello Ficino, even to a lesser extent, Francis Bacon, of course, Dr. John Dee, and, you read works by people like Peter French and Francis Yates, and this work just really impressed me. I wasn't a Mason at the time, I mean, I was only 20, 21 years old over there, but the material stuck with me, and I continued to research it, and I ultimately graduated Gettysburg College, and in the late 1990s, I went to law school in Delaware. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. And when I was in law school, or right before I went to law school, the opportunity presented itself to join a Masonic lodge here in Baltimore, and I took it. I was invited to join, and I became a third-degree free lodge or Blue Lodge Mason in 1997. And shortly before I graduated law school, this would have been around October of 1999, I became a 32nd degree Freemason of the Scottish Rite here in Baltimore. And while I was in law school, I continued to keep this, I continued to do this research. And of course, now being a Mason, I became exposed to people like Albert Pike, Albert Mackey, Manly Palmer Hall, who are really writing about the esoteric and mystical side of Freemasonry. And this really just impressed me. And it really wasn't until I continued to doing the research, and it really wasn't until around 2005, 2006, with the advent of the social media on the internet, and this, of course, predated Twitter and Facebook and things like that. It was with a social networking page called MySpace. And I created this MySpace page, and I really just started sharing the research that I was doing about sort of the esoteric side of Freemasonry, the astrological symbolisms, the solar symbolisms, you know, the mystical elements of it. And the page was really popular. I was posting blogs, photo galleries, things of that nature. And it was around, I guess, 2006, 2007, I was approached by a friend of mine. This person's no longer alive. Who said he had seen the MySpace page and said, you know, this is all real good and fine, Rob, but why don't you commit yourself to writing a book and you can just memorialize all this information, for all time. And, you know, it was a great idea. It was what I had planned on really doing anyway. So really starting around 2006, 2007, I just really started putting pen to paper, and writing this book and, putting in the research that I had done. And the book was completed in the summer of 2011, and it came out in August of 2012.
Very good. Now, so let's talk about how you got your eye on the seventh degree of the York Rite, the Royal Arch Mason, because if you join Scottish Rite, I think 32nd is called, what is it, the Sublime Prince of the Royal Secret, Master of the Royal Secret.
That's me.
So how did you, how does it work, let's say? Because, I mean, everyone, as just as I have done right now, can Google the structure of Freemasonry and look at this nice image of, you know, how it's laid out and everything. But, I have no idea how it works within the order. So how did you get your eye on the York Rite and one of the degrees therein?
Well, the Royal Arch degree is in both the York and Scottish Rite. I'm not a York Rite Mason. The York Rite is part of the high degrees. It's just a separate rite. It's like Scottish Rite, only it has different elements. The Scottish Rite, like you said, is 32nd. The 7th degree in the York Rite is the Royal Arch. It's the 13th in the Scottish Rite. Both the York Rite and the Scottish Rite, these high degrees, and this is really murky history that you're getting into. It's almost like a chicken or the egg question. The York Rite and the Scottish Rite are both born out of the same thing. It's these 25 degrees coming out of Paris, France in the 1730s called the Rite of Perfection. They're 25 degrees. They come into America. They're basically midwifed into America through Haiti. And they come in, and a guy named Henry Franklin or Franklin creates this Rite of Perfection in Albany, New York. And it's through this Rite of Perfection that is born the York Rite of T.S. Webb and ultimately the Supreme Council of the World, which is the the Scottish Rite degrees, ultimately the 32nd and, of course, the honorary 33rd degree. Mm. The Royal Arch degree in the York Rite, it's actually called the Royal Arch of Zorobabel. In the Scottish Rite, it's the 13th degree, and this ties into your number 13 symbolism. Which is, replete all over the place.
So that's the one, Robert, that you stumbled over on then in your path, up to the 32nd. And was there something that stood out to you particularly with the 13th degree?
Absolutely. The 13th degree, and this is where you get into some really deep Masonic lore, is to answer your question, to really answer it thoroughly, you have to go back to the Blue Lodge, and you have to understand what's going on there. I'm gonna have to answer that first to get to the 13th degree, because what happens in the Blue Lodge, I'm going to try to condense this, essentially in the third degree, this is the Master Mason degree, the ritual revolves around a guy who's building the first temple named Hiram Abiff, and he possesses what is called the Tetragrammaton. It's this lost name of God. He has it, and it's through the correct pronunciation of this name that learning and mathematics is made possible. In the third degree ritual, Abiff is murdered by three fellow crafts, prior to the completion of the temple, and when he's killed, the word is lost. It's gone. It's gone. When he dies, it disappears with him. Well, if you fast forward now to the Scottish Rite degrees and the High degrees, it's this 13th degree, this Royal Arch degree, where the name of God, Hiram Abiff's lost word, the lost word of a master mason, is recovered. They find it. They find the name of God. They find it in his underground vault that has been concealed on the Temple Mount. And it's this recovery of this Tetragrammaton, the name of God, which is really the penultimate, if you will, symbol of Freemasonry. It's the lost word of a master mason. And if you get into Masonic lore, and this gets into the Book of Enoch, the Vault of Enoch is containing this lost, legitimate wisdom that the Freemasons basically are symbolically restoring. And to me, it's this 13th degree, which is really the penultimate degree in all of Freemasonry.
Before we get into talking more about Enoch, the Book of Enoch, and of course his testimony, if you will, how this was found and everything, let's spend a little bit on the origins of Freemasonry itself, because that is also, of course, a big question. There are some people who claim that they're sticking strictly to 1717 and, the goose and gridiron behind St. Paul's Cathedral right there, while some people like Robert Lomas, for example, talks about that it's evidence of Masonic architectural style in the Chapel of Roslyn in Scotland. And this, they started in 1440, I think. How far back do you go when it comes to the origins of Freemasonry, Robert?
Well, as modern day, it's an interesting question. As modern day Freemasonry stands, it's what you said, it's 1717. Now, what happens is, and I think this is where a lot of this information is coming from, when the Grand Lodge, this is really a key thing here between, when you're talking about the history of Freemasonry, between Blue Lodge Freemasonry and the High Degrees. In 1717, when the rite is really developed, it's the first three degrees of Freemasonry. It's what you call your Blue Lodge. Shortly after its form, a guy named James Anderson writes this legendary history where he traces Masonry back basically to the Garden of Eden. It's legendary. But what he attributes it to is, and this is where like Lomas gets into it, is that basically it was originating from these Germanic stonecutters and stoneworkers who possessed these biblical secrets, if you will, about stone construction, architecture, things of that nature. So, as the actual as Freemasonry as it exists today is from 1717. Now, how far you want to go back beyond that, and especially when you start getting into things like the Hermetic tradition, influences of like Rosicrucianism, things like that on it. I mean, yeah, you can definitely trace it back further. I mean, you could, really trace it back. I mean, if you understand like the solar iconography of a lot of Blue Lodge Freemasonry, I mean, you could take that back almost to Egypt, if you will.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is, and this is where there's this sort of split with Masonry, is you have these blue degrees, the Blue Lodge. Well, it's in France in the 1730s that a guy named Andrew Michael the Chevalier Ramsay comes along. And what he does is he issues in 1737 his famed oration. And what he does is he doesn't challenge Anderson, but he says, yeah, and Anderson is right that there is evidence of, Freemasonry coming out of these medieval German stoneworkers, no doubt about that. He said, and this is where it's key, he said, the Freemasonry is really a creation of a group of medieval warrior monks called the Knights Templar. And Freemasonry is basically an agent of the Pope in Rome. And this causes all kinds of dissension and problems within Freemasonry, but it's out of Ramsay's oration of 1737 that these high degrees are being born out of.
And of course the Knights Templar, that's also really where the Scottish and the York Rite kind of meet almost there at the top, isn't that right?
Well, it's when Ramsay gives his oration, shortly thereafter you have these 25 degrees coming out of France called the Rite of Perfection. And like I said, this is where these degrees come into the United States, and it's through these 25 degrees that basically are born out of the Scottish Rite and the York Rite. What is controversial with this, and what I kind of get into in mine with my book, is it appears to me, at least on its face value, if you really understand it. I mean, other Masonic authors have talked about this, such as the biggies, Albert Mackey, but it appears that the high degrees, as it were, And this is where, you know, you really get into some, you know, deep muddy waters, if you will. The 25 degrees coming out of this, out of Paris, France in the 1700s looks like it was being developed by the Jesuits, at this place called the College of Clermont. And, you know, when you hear that, people think, well, what do the Jesuits want to have to do with Freemasonry?
Right, yeah.
But it's really what they're doing. It's part of the Counter-Reformation. And what they're trying to do is they're symbolically trying to lure Protestants back to the Pope in Rome through these capitular higher degrees of Freemasonry. It's a neat little trick they're pulling. Now, whether Ramsay's oration, whether he intended for that to happen, probably is kind of lost to history, but it definitely seems that there is, you know, this Jesuit influence on these high degrees. I mean, when you look at Blue Lodge Freemasonry of 1717 in England, and you look at the higher degrees, I mean, they contradict each other. You know, you have the Blue Lodge, which is preaching things such as, you know, equality, you know, anti-Vatican, you know, this sort of, you know, brotherhood, universal brotherhood, equality. But when you get into the high degrees, you'll definitely find themes of papal monarchy. I mean, it's like you said earlier, you know, it's the royal secret. You know, it's the royal arch.
Yeah.
It's elements of what you would call papal monarchy. And it seems to be coming out of the Jesuit College of Clermont. And this is one of their Counter-Reformation tricks, if you will.
Well, this is a very interesting point that you're talking about here. You have a passage on this in the beginning of the book. I wanted to read that. I'm having it up right now here. Here it is. Blue Lodge Masonry and its 3 degrees of Entered Apprentice, Fellowship, Craft, and Master Mason is egalitarian, just as you said, Robert. As such, it fundamentally opposes concepts like monarchy and ecclesiastical rule. Yet the Masonic high degrees of the Scottish and York Rite embraces ideals such as divine kingship and religiosity, a contradiction, basically, just what you said. And I've always wondered about that, too, because I've heard on one level that, you know, yeah, brotherhood and egalitarianism, that's like, you know, behind some of the ideals of Masonry. Yet at the same time, I can see that, you know, even our King of Sweden is like, he's the royal protector of the order, you know, stuff like that. So it's like, wait a minute, what is the connection here? If they're behind democratic organizations, as they say, on one level, and liberty, and yet on the other level, they're, you know, deeply embedded, if you will, with the royals. How does that work? Tell us more about this contradiction.
Yeah, it's what it comes out of is, the contradiction is, like we were just saying, it's Blue Lodge, it's this sort of theme of universal brotherhood, but when you get into the high degrees, it's part of is the Counter-Reformation. And what it ultimately is coming back to, it's like you talked about with the, you know, the king. I mean, even in Victorian England, I mean, and I can't remember the exact title. I think Queen Victoria was known as the protectress of the craft.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get themes of monarchy. And what this really stems from, it comes from Ramsay's 1737 oration, where he links Freemasonry to this group of warrior monks called the Templars. And, of course, the Templars were basically Roman Catholic, you know, warrior monk style priests who were answerable to the Pope in Rome. And it's definitely this sort of Jesuit contradiction that they're basically creating these high degrees. And I mean, you know, like I said, the thing with, you know, this ties into the, you know, concept of, you know, high degree Freemasonry in the United States, but it's this, you know, what's lost in the Blue Lodge is recovered in the high degrees. And when you recover this tetragrammaton, it's almost like a symbolic restoration of monarchy, if you will. And what Albert Mackey argues, and I tend to agree with him, is that the high degrees, as part of this Jesuit, you know, Counter-Reformation ideology, if you will, that they seem to be a vehicle, at least they were in the 1700s, of trying to restore the Stuart pretenders back to the throne of England. Was what the high degrees seem to ultimately have been based upon. Hmm. When they come into the United States, and these 25 degrees come in, they're reworked, and sort of this, you know, the themes of monarchy and, you know, what we were just talking about remain. But what happens? Something really unique happens, where it's different from the European version, and. It's a long story. I mean, we can get into
sure.
it, but,
yep.
you know, it's what happens is it's a guy in America named Thomas Smith Webb, what he does is he reworks the High Degrees, where instead of it basically embracing papal monarchy, what he kind of, and this is how it gets filtered into the Scottish Rite also, but again, this is a chicken and egg question. But what Webb does is, and this is getting to the York Rite, he's ultimately the main guy behind the York Rite. What Webb says is, in his monitor, was in this degree, this royal arch degree, when the candidate beholds the name of God in this underground vault, basically, instead of it being a link to monarchy of Europe or European monarchy, that the candidate is now a citizen king himself. Sort of this, new age perfected citizen of this new world democracy. And that's sort of the nexus or the split, if you will, with the difference between sort of the American version of it and the European version of it.
Yeah, very interesting. Again, just to kind of go over some of these points here again, if we look at an organization like the Jacobins, they're really like a really far left radical organization. They've been known for their implementation of what they call the Reign of Terror. And this organization, the Jacobins, who's in France at the time during the French Revolution, is also kind of really laying the groundwork for other organizations like the Illuminati, which comes out of this pretty much. And in the ranks of the Illuminati, you also have aristocrats, but they're counter monarchy, basically. When I look back into history, it's like it's impossible for us to know the true intentions of those people who started these organizations and what the true purpose of them is. I mean, Adam Weishaupt himself was a Jesuit. So does that have anything to do with it? And I mean, as I look back, it's like it is really muddy, the waters. What do you make of these far-left organizations that are anti-monarchy, but then at the end seems to become associated with monarchy itself? Isn't it weird?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you just said. I was interviewed about this, and when you're talking about a group, I'm glad we're talking about this, like a group like the Illuminati. When I mention the Illuminati, like you, I'm talking about the Adam Weishaupt 1776 Illuminati.
Yeah.
And like you said, these guys are the guys who are like the Pythagorean, passion, fire, revolutionary zeal. But what's interesting is, it's like you said, it's this sort of element of duplicity with these guys. Weishaupt and a lot of the members of the Illuminati are, trained by the Jesuits. And, when you trace the Illuminati in history, and this is where it really gets interesting, in my opinion, is if you look at the history of the Jesuits, Here's the problem, Henrik, is people are looking, like you just said, people are looking at groups like the Jesuits through like a 21st century eyeglass. That is a total mistake.
Yeah.
If you go back in time to when the Jesuits were formed by Ignatius of Loyola, I mean, he created the Jesuits to be this Osirian, Isian, Egyptian solar priesthood. These guys were mystics. These guys in Europe were basically, your CIA of Europe in the 17th century, basically.
Right.
You tell people this, I mean, they just fall over backwards. One of the most learned Jesuits out there was a guy named Athanasius Kircher.
Yeah.
And he's a Jesuit priest, and he writes extensively. He's a Jesuit. I mean, he says, listen, I'm a Jesuit. He said, Christianity is just corrupted, Egyptian sun worship. And you've got the Jesuits plotting to kill Queen Elizabeth I. They're constantly, meddling in European politics. And we get to the Illuminati of 1776. Well, in 1773, Pope Clement XIV tries to put the Jesuits out of business because of their political meddlings, their Egyptian occultism, their scheming. And it's right after, the suppression of the Society of Jesus in 1773. Well, bang, what do you have? The Illuminati on the scene. And there is a German aristocrat, and this is the guy I think you're talking about, and I believe his last name is Knigge. It may be Knig.
Yeah, Knigge.
He joins the Illuminati. He's sort of the, for lack of a better word, the de facto leader of German occultism in that time frame. He's a Freemason. He joins the Illuminati of Weishaupt, and he brings with him a whole host of Freemasons with him. And it's exactly what you say. He thinks, okay, I'm joining this Eagle Tower, this New World Brotherhood. It's anti-Pope. It's anti-Rome. We have religious freedoms. you know, we're going to have this equal society, everything's going to be great. Well, Carnegie leaves shortly after, and he writes a treatise, and he says, look, I joined this group. He said, you know, these guys like Weishaupt, von Born, yeah, I mean, they say one thing. He said, these guys are just all the Jesuits under another name.
Well, that's just what he said. He said he accused Weishaupt of Jesuitism. He suspected him of being a Jesuit in disguise.
That's right, so yeah.
He bails out there, yeah.
And then, you know, when it gets murky again is you have, you know, during the height of the Napoleonic Wars, the Illuminati sort of fades a little bit into the background. But then what happens at the conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars? Well, bang, the Jesuits are restored along with the Papal States. So, I mean, it's like the Jesuits just went underground for this, you know, time frame of the French Revolution and the time of Napoleon. They're suppressed. They change their name, and then they reemerge, and everything's, you know, back to square one, back to normal, if you will.
So we have the Jesuits and the Vatican with the Knights Templar or the Knights of Malta in the extension on one end. And then on the other, if this is the division, and it depends on what, you know, where in history we're talking about this as well, because there's been allegiances in different times, and these are groups who are maybe at a later date actually are, you know, going at each other. So this is, you know, we have to clarify this, I guess. But one of the simplifications that have been made, that's what I'm trying to get to, is that there have been kind of a war between the Vatican and Freemasons, or you know, those who are aligned to the more of the Freemasonic organization. Is that generally a correct assessment, do you think, Robert?
Well, I think that when, you know, the Vatican sees Blue Lodge Freemasonry as a bit of a threat because it's deism, and it's, you know, you can be, you know, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Zoroastrian, as long as you believe in a supreme being, you can join a Masonic lodge. This kind of goes against, you know, the whole concept of, you know, accepting Jesus Christ as your personal savior. In Freemasonry, you don't have to do that. You just have to believe in what's called a supreme being, or, you know, God, the great architect, call it what you want. The Vatican, you know, flip-flops on Freemasonry. They kind of go against it. They really don't like it. The Vatican seems to, you know, have completely lost control of the Jesuits. They're doing their own thing. But finally, really, the Vatican kind of just throws in the towel on Freemasonry. You know, certainly when the United States is created in 1776 or 1781, I mean, obviously at that point in time, you know, you have this, you're outside the parameters of Europe, if you will. So, you know, Freemasonry can flourish in this new world, you know, which has democratic freedoms. And, you know, separation of church and state, which comes out of the constitutions of Freemasonry, by the way, from Anderson. But it's really in the 19th century, in the later part, and I don't know the date on this, but basically that's when sort of the Vatican just kind of throws in the towel on Freemasonry, and they create a Roman Catholic version of Blue Lodge Freemasonry, and it's called the Knights of Columbus.
And
that basically, what in a nutshell happens is, the Vatican says, look, if you want to, if you're Catholic and you want to join a secret society, this is the one for you. And that's when kind of by that point in time, you're getting into the 20th century and, you know, the Vatican's got bigger fish to fry at that point in time.
Yeah. I think it was, Bill Clinton who, was in Knights of the Columbus. He always goes back to talk about that. I know. In regard, all right, so, you know, we have that. Let's keep that in the back of our heads as we continue our conversation here. Yeah,
it's deep material. I mean,
oh, sure.
You know, I mean, it's without a question. And I think you know, when people are coming to this material for the first time, you can really sit back and scratch your head. But if you look at it in a legitimate historical context, it's like putting a puzzle together. You know, it's like, why is this group doing that? And why is this group doing this? You know, where is these elements of duplicity coming into it? You know, and again, you know, we were talking about the Illuminati and the Jesuits. You'll see the same exact theme in this European 19th century secret society called the Carbonari, which is, you know, this revolutionary fire yet seemed to be, you know, working to restore Italy as one state and bring it together. You know, but on the other hand, we're trying to create these worldwide revolutions. It's a theme that runs throughout this stuff.
Definitely. Yeah. So let's keep that, you know, in the back of our heads as we continue, and we'll see if we can tie that in later and return to that. Let's just shift our focus to Enoch a little bit here, because that's obviously a big section of your book. So let's just detail this kind of from the beginning, who Enoch is, how all of this led to become the Book of Enoch, eventually one that actually is excluded from the Bible. But let's begin at the beginning and what you know.
Yeah, this is really the crux of what my book is about. The Book of Enoch, well, let's say who Enoch was at first. He's one of two people in the Bible to never die a physical death. He actually enters heaven in corporeal form. He doesn't enter as a spirit. He enters as a human. And what the Book of Enoch does, it dates from around 350 Common Era, and or 350 BCE, excuse me. And what the Book of Enoch documents is what he sees in heaven when he's up there hanging out with the angels and what have you. And he sees some very interesting things. The first thing he sees is, this ties into why it's most likely left out of the Bible. He's told that the tree of life, this is the tree of the garden of Adam and Eve, is really Hebrew Kabbalah, the Sephirotic tree, and that one of the Sephirots is symbolically the apple that Eve bit, granting her wisdom. But then he's introduced to this group of fallen angels called the Watchers. And these are guys that the archangels are keeping a real tight, close eye on. And these guys are the angels who have fallen to earth and have sired this race of giants by mating with human females called the Nephilim. And Enoch serves as sort of this intermediary with these fallen angels, where he's trying to get them back into heaven and back under God's good graces. This turns into a philosophy called universalism, which basically echoes this theory that I'm getting off a little off the beaten track, but just okay. Echoes the idea that in the end days, even Satan and his fallen demons will one day be forgiven by God and allowed back into heaven. Hmm. And that basically, at this point in time, God has seen enough suffering in hell and doesn't want the devil down there anymore. And he forgives them. And he forgives everybody in hell and lets them into heaven. What Enoch, and this is where things really get interesting for me, is when Enoch's hanging out with these fallen angels, these watchers, he gleans knowledge from them. And in a nutshell, the knowledge he gleans is ultimately what ultimately becomes mathematics and the seven liberal arts and sciences, writing, arithmetic, language, things of that nature. Well, this is, according to Masonic lore, when Enoch returns to Earth, and I can't remember what his exact relation is. He's either the grandfather or the great-grandfather of Noah. This is the Noah of the flood of Noah. And when Enoch returns to Earth, what he does is he catches wind that God wants to eradicate mankind by the flood. But what Enoch does is he tricks God. He's going to fool him. He's going to pull one over on him. What he does is he takes this wisdom that he's learned from these fallen angels, this ultimately demonic wisdom, and he inscribes it on two pillars, which are called the Pillars of Enoch. And what he does is he puts these pillars in this underground vault under nine archways, and he conceals it to survive the flood of Noah. And what he does in between these two pillars, he puts the name of God, the Tetragrammaton, on this golden delta. And it's only through the correct pronunciation of that word, this is, of course, the word of a master mason, that you can restore that information on those two pillars. And in Masonic lore and in this degree, the masons are finding that underground vault and restoring that knowledge which God was trying to eradicate. And in Masonic lore, this is the Royal Arch degree. This is it. It's the recovery of the treasure vault on the Temple Mount. The treasure being the name of God and these two pillars with this wisdom. I mean, this is the first National Treasure movie. I mean, just all but verbatim. And when in the Masonic lore, when the Masons and the Stone Builders discover this underground vault, they realize it's already been breached by two people. Two people have already gotten in there and pronounced the name of God correctly and restored this lost wisdom. The first character is a character, and here's a tongue twister for you. His name is Thoth Hermes Mercurius Trismegistus. And he pronounces the name of God and restores the several liberal arts. If you've got the symbolic eye, you will always see Hermes around schools on school logos. This is a Masonic emblem of the seven liberal arts and high education. The other guy is a Greek mathematician named Pythagoras. And he breaches the vault, pronounces the name of God, and restores mathematics to the world, namely the 47th proposition of Euclid, the emblem of a worshipful master. This is where Pythagoras has his eureka moment in the vault of Enoch, right? I found it. It being the Tetragrammaton and the restoration of the mathematical knowledge. What my book, documents is this knowledge, what I was just talking about, the Book of Enoch is off the history pages from around two common era to the late 1700s, when a Freemason named James Bruce returns to Europe from Ethiopia with copies of 1 Enoch. They go into the Bodleian Library, they basically go into the basement where they sit till 1821, where they're not even translated into English. The historical anomaly is this, is that these high degree rituals, and this is what we were talking about earlier, this 25 degrees of the Rite of Perfection and this Royal Arch degree is documenting the elements of the Book of Enoch, which should not be happening. That is a historical anomaly that should not be going on.
Are you saying that the tradition, if you will, of these or the initiations are incorporated into Freemasonry, but they haven't been the Book of Enoch, where they are contained within, haven't been discovered yet? Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely right. Is this high degree ritual, this 13th degree of the Rite of Perfection, coming out of France in the 1730s, is incorporating elements of the Book of Enoch, which should not be happening. I mean, that is a total historical anomaly, because the Book of Enoch at that point in time was off the history books. I mean, it's not even translated into English until 1821. I mean, it's some 60-some years later almost in Oxford. What my ultimate conclusion is this, is clearly, and I don't know where it is, there was clearly a Book of Enoch, or at least a very detailed summary of it, floating around Europe and France at this time. And, you know, who had it or who saw it, you know, this what I get into is, I mean, we're speculating here, of course, but we have to do this, is, you know, my ultimate conclusion is, if you just stand back and look at it objectively, the guy who most likely saw this thing was this guy Ramsay, it's from his oration that this high degree is ultimately born, and Ramsay's associated big time with the Jesuits, and it's most likely that somewhere out there in France or some secret Jesuit library, there was already a copy of this book floating around Europe. And, you know, that's this big historical anomaly that's going on.
Well, exactly. It could just simply be hidden history, that the tradition has been known by a few people for a long, long, long time, but it's not actually until this is recovered and translated that it becomes, you know, known to the masses, if you will. This is pretty common. But what that points to as well is that the tradition and the knowledge have been obviously passed down by people who have been initiated into these different groups, basically, for a very, very long time, correct?
I would say that there's some truth to that, but there seems to me to be more of an issue of, when these high degrees are being born, someone, this guy Ramsay, must have seen a copy of this book somewhere, or at least a detailed summary of it, which he's using, which is ultimately being used to create this high degree, because the book of some of the contents of the Book of Enoch is going into this ritual. It's basically, in a nutshell, it's this concept of this lost yet restored knowledge, you know, that God was trying to eradicate from with the flood of Noah. That's really the crux of the degree. And Ramsay or somebody in Europe clearly saw a copy of this thing, or a summary of it. Now, when we get into, like you're talking about, you know, maybe this is more of like a traditional thing being handed down through secret orders, such as like the Rosicrucians, that's more difficult to pin down. I mean, that's really kind of, you know, that's getting a little bit more on the extra, you know, almost, I don't want to say fringe, but it's definitely more harder to pin down. I mean, I could pin down that Ramsay saw a summary of this thing or a copy of it. I mean, that's what basically the crux of my book is about. But I will say this much to you, and this kind of gets to what you're saying to me about, you know, this sort of lost tradition being handed down, and maybe, you know, other people saw this Book of Enoch. There, that is very possible, because if, you know, it turns up really two other places. If you remove the Masonic high degrees and the Rite of Perfection and Ramsay aside, Sir Walter Raleigh, in one of his books, I think it's The History of the World, actually hints that the Book of Enoch has an astronomy astrological book, and he's correct. So Raleigh seems to maybe have known something also. And then, of course, you've got the Enochian, you know, magic and language of this English mystic named John Dee. You know, and again, here we go. It's, you know, the language of the angels. You know, what's it called? What's named Enochian? I mean, it's named after Enoch.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly there may be, I mean, you know, Dee had a huge library. So, I mean, there's definitely a very real possibility. I suggested in the book that maybe even Dee had a copy of this thing, or at least a summary of it, or something to that effect.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's where it gets really interesting, what actually is contained therein and the knowledge and everything else. I mean, I also think I read this from your book that, you know, Solomon, basically, where a lot of this goes back to, the building of the temple. We have architectural, you know, background here and a connection actually to how you build and construct certain things as an occult art, pretty much. But also the use of you know, quote unquote, good and evil angels are actually part of this as well. And I think that this goes to the heart of the matter of Enochian magic as well, of actually evoking an invocation towards these different deities that are out there to be able to use them in your advantage, I guess, to a certain degree. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. I got onto an internet chat room. This was about 6-7 months ago, and I was talking to another Freemason. He kind of got a little spooked out by this information. Yeah, you got to remember that when you're talking about, you know, this knowledge that's, you know, I mean, this is really sort of the polemics of anti-Masonry. It's this concept that the Masons are preservers of this lost wisdom that God was trying to eradicate. So, I mean, it's you're basically trying, what it really comes down to is you're defying the will of God is really what you're stemming, you know, is really what the nut, you know, the heart of the matter with anti-Masonry is really where it comes from. When you get into sort of things, like you said, you know, with Enoch getting this magic from basically a bunch of demons, you know, this is reflected in these medieval grimoires, such as the Clavicule of Solomon, the Testament of Solomon, Ars Goetia, where Solomon, you know, is presented as this wise sort of wizard who is manipulating demons for the advantage of mankind. And, you know, this is, you know, been documented all over the place where Solomon is given this signet ring by the Archangel Michael, I want to say, and it's on this ring, which is the Seal of Solomon. Depending on what source you read, it's either a pentagram or a hexagram or some sort of combination of both. And it's with this signet ring that he's able to manipulate these 72 demons. These are the 72 demons in Ars Goetia, which is probably the most famous grimoire of them all, if you will. And he uses these 72 demons to help construct the first temple to God. Ultimately, these demons rebel. I mean, here we go again with this concept of the fallen demons, the fallen angels. And what he does is he seals the demons up in this brass vessel. This is the legend. This is where this concept of the genie, you know, the genie in the bottle comes from, of these demons being encased in this brass vessel by Solomon, which he seals with the Seal of Solomon. And that's the genie in the bottle legend. But yeah, I mean, you know, you get into characters like Dee, who is just, you know, this really fascinating guy. It always irks me that, you know, someone like that has been just, I mean, at least from, I'm in America. I mean, I'm in Baltimore, Maryland right now. And I mean, I can tell you, this guy has just been written off the history books out here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to do your own research, you know, to find out about this guy. I mean, again, you know, there's a great book on Dee by a guy named Peter French, which is in my bibliography. But yeah, Dee is a Elizabethan. He's into navigation. He pioneers navigation. He has this huge library. He serves as a mystic and astrologer to Queen Elizabeth I. He's one of Walsingham's spies, and he practices this magic called Enochian with this Irish sidekick named Edward Kelly. And what they do is they create this language, and it's the language of the angels, and it's very complex. And is trying to invoke these demons to grant knowledge extraworldly knowledge, you know, knowledge of the heavens, this forbidden knowledge. You know, that's what he's invoking them for. The D character, or not character, John Dee is he's Faust. He's the Christopher Marlowe Faust character, who is, making pacts with Mephistopheles to gain this forbidden knowledge. And again, that goes into Goethe's Faustus, which is, Goethe was, of course, a Freemason and a Luminist also. And you'll see Dee reflected in Shakespeare's The Tempest. He's Prospero in that one as well. Just a fascinating character. And, you know, it's this concept of gaining this lost, you know, all but sometimes evil knowledge for the betterment of mankind.
And here, I guess, this is where the real schism is. Here is where a lot of people, you know, have an aversion to this. They think that this is an evil art, it should be left alone. We don't know what we're dealing with. These are, you know, wicked forces, occult forces, etc. And on the one hand, we can ask you, of course, Robert, if you agree with that to a certain extent. And on the other hand, to what extent should mankind peer into these unknown abysses, if you will, to be able to learn more about their own world? But potentially, could it be? Do you agree that this actually has to do with setting ourselves free to a certain extent? That this is what we've heard about, of course, that this has to do with a rebellion, basically, against God on one level. But it's the reason for that rebellion is to be able to, you know, learn what things are for ourselves, to step outside of that box, if you will, and to actually, you know, advance and attain something higher as a human being. And that's where a lot of people disagree. But what do you make of all this, Robert?
Well, what that really is stemming from, I think, is what's called the Hermetic tradition coming out of the Renaissance, where basically these guys like Ficino and Pico della Mandarola were trying to understand nature. You know, the actual, you know, Hermetic tradition is to become, you know, like God, is to, you know, figure out this stuff on your own. Whether a person wants to practice white or black magic is really up to them. It's not anything I subscribe to. I want to do it. But again, you know, when you're getting into these sort of themes of the occult, and when you're talking about like what you were saying about like with the demons and the architecture, you know, I mean, a lot of people think it's really this, you know, dark forces. Well, it kind of is, but it really isn't. what I'm trying to say is, I guess, is, you know, there are a lot of writers in history, for example, just right off the bat, you look at like some architecture in the Federal District of Washington, D.C., and people see it and they see that it doesn't really reflect what you would call, you know, Orthodox Christianity. So all of a sudden it's, you know, evil or demonism. Well, that's really not the case. You can go back in time to the Renaissance, where this Hermetic tradition is being developed. This concept of, you know, I mean, this ultimately leads to what's called the scientific revolution, where, you know, it's science, the Baconian method, if you will, where, you know, you got guys, like Ficino, who is, he's translating the Corpus Emeticum, which is this book alleged to be written by this guy, Hermes Trismegistus. And in that, you know, in this is Hermes' maxim. He carries it around this thing called the Emerald Tablet, which is the maxim of as above, so below, which in a nutshell involves that if you're going to build an architectural edifice of import, you should, you know, make sure it's astrologically aligned correctly. You know, you want to align it to certain stars. You know, this can be done through cornerstone ceremonies, you know, memory devices embedded in the architecture. This is turned into the writings of a Renaissance master. He's a Christian mystic named Raymond Lully. He writes extensively of what's called the art of memory, where if you're going to build a building, you want to create these symbolic zodiac-styled memory temples. His work goes forward into the works of Giordano Bruno, the Dominican friar who took Nicholas Copernicus's theory about the heavens to a new daring extreme, and it ultimately cost him his life. They burned him at the stake. But, you know, he talks also about this concept of the art of memory, creating these sublime, you know, esoteric, even, you know, maybe a little bit occult memory temples. But I don't really foresee it as some sort of evil, you know, big black demonic force or anything like that. It's basically trying to reflect nature, the heavens, the stars, trying to, you know, get closer to God. But like you said, there is sort of this contradiction where you're using this knowledge that God kind of was trying to, you know, at least curtail or eradicate. So, you know, it's a murky answer. It's sort of a little duplicitous, but that's really the crux of it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, again, it just goes back to what you said before with Anastasius Kircher or some of those people that come out of the world of you know, Jesuitism and stuff like that, but yet they come into these kind of occult arts, if you will. I wanted to ask you something else, basically. Well, if this has anything to do with, the basic thing I was thinking about when you were talking about this is that who is this for? Is this for the human beings that are going to, let's say, use the building? Is it a greater ritual that is designed for communication with a higher force, i.e. God or these angels that you're talking about? I've always been very curious to know, like, if it benefits somebody, or if it's helpful, if you know what I'm getting at, except being, of course, an expression of sacred geometry and stuff like that, of course.
Well, that's it. It's basically you're trying to, I think I understand your question. It's basically, you know, whether it's beneficial, I think, is, you know, sort of an individual, you know, interpretation of it.
Right.
If you're trying to align these buildings to, you know, draw on their astral energies, if you will. I mean, this goes all the way back. You know, I mean, you could see it in Egypt with the pyramids. Now they're saying, you know, that the three pyramids are aligned to the three stars in Orion's belt. You know, I mean, with things like Stonehenge has all kind of astronomical, you know, alignments, things of that nature. It's really, you're just trying to draw on this stellar solar energy. You know, it's, like I said, it's the as above, so below. You want to bring what's in the heavens down to mankind to make it more positive. You know, and you'll see, you know, I mean, I've got a whole chapter on it. And, you know, you'll see these astrological symbols and alignments going on in the Federal District or Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, this has come to light, you know, much more in the last 10 years. And, you know, it's you know, you can trace it, you know, you can trace it back further into antiquity if you want. But you can also, a lot of these guys, you know, like you were just saying, you know, you can read the works of Raymond Lully, Kircher, you know, Bruno, you know, who talk about this hermetic tradition of basically making mankind like God, if you will.
Yeah, it's a very interesting one. There's so much to this, of course, and in a few minutes we're going to take a break and we're going to continue. There's just so many more aspects to this that we want to talk about. I wanted to go back to a few other points here, though, that we discussed kind of a little bit previously or were alluding to. The angels, basically, want to try to detail this a little bit more, and if there's any, as far as you are concerned, knowledge about who these, you know, creatures really are, because you made the tie with basically that this might be kind of a Nephilim type entities that actually had interactions with mankind on that level. Some people speculate that they're completely ethereal, but we can tap into that field of information, if you will, under circumstances like rituals, etc. Is there any way you've been able to detail of who we're actually dealing with, who they are?
Sure. In the Book of Enoch, I have a copy here. I mean, I don't have a antique copy. I mean, I just have a, you know, modern copy. But in the Book of Enoch, let me just real quick, one of the things that distinguishes the Book of Enoch from other holy scripture, it's not the only one like this, but the Book of Enoch is written in the first person. You know, where, like in the Bible, in the Old and New Testament, it's, you know, Moses did this, Jesus did that, you know, the 12 apostles did this. In the Book of Enoch, it's Enoch writing. He says, I did this. He said, you know, I went into the, you know, I went here. I saw this angel. I then met with this archangel.
Yeah.
You know, then this archangel told me about the sun. This archangel told me about the moon. You know, this archangel told me this. You know, stay away from this one, but do this. In the Book of Enoch, he names them. And I don't have the copy in front of me, but he actually names out all the archangels, and then he names out the fallen angels. He gives them the names. He said, this one's named this. This one's the mathematician. This fallen angel's this. This one's the astronomer. You know, this fallen angel is this. This is the one who can read. This fallen angel does this. This is the one who knows how to write. He names them out. I mean, they have very Judaic mystical names. I can't remember any of them off the top of my head, but if you pull up the Book of Enoch, it's in there. I mean, he names them.
Do you think that, I mean, could we simply be talking about an interaction with another species from another planet? Is it that simple, or is there something else going on here?
Well, that's completely a judgment call. I mean, you know, whether or not this guy, you know, Enoch is the guy that, if you read like Eric von Däniken and those guys, you know, he's like the, what's his name? Ezekiel, who goes up in the solar chariot.
Yeah, yeah.
That this is some sort of extraterrestrial sort of vehicle of some kind. That is completely open to speculation. I don't really, to me personally, that's sort of like a second, not a secondary, but sort of like a side issue for me. And with my book, it's really the more important thing is he gets this knowledge and then what does he do with it? And what the book documents is, you know, it's this knowledge that, you know, God was trying to eradicate, but survived the flood of Noah and is ultimately, you know, being restored by the Freemasons in this 13th degree, you know, Masonic ritual. You know, and again, you know, this reflects the Book of Enoch because that ritual in the Scottish Rite, you know, this has numerous solar, you know, an astrological symbolisms. You know, this is all coming out of the Book of Enoch. Whether or not, you know, Enoch is going to some sort of ethereal realm or some extraterrestrial, you know, abode, if you will, that's sort of, you know, kind of left to speculation, if you will. Interest in it, my interest really was, what does he do with the knowledge?
Exactly. That's a good point. That's something I really want to get into more in the second hour as well. A little bit briefly on this, though, why do you think that it is that God tried to eradicate this knowledge, that there is this kind of schism and we have this break in heaven, if you will, of, you know, the fallen angels, as a group of them are basically, you know, cast down to earth, I think, or to hell. But there seems to be, as I look at much of the theology and looking back in different scriptures and stuff like that, you get the sense of it, I get the sense of it anyway, that we're also dealing with different gods, if you will. It's not just one. There seems to be if it was, you know, schizophrenic, if nothing else. Yahweh seems to be, you know, have different gods at some points, right?
Well, and you also have that line in Genesis where it's, you know, what I can't remember. You'll know it better than me. It's where he says, what, you know, man was made in our image.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's the plural. It's the plural. It's not the singular. So, I mean, you know, and you're clearly dealing, you know, it clearly seems to be reflecting that, you know, there's more than one of these things, or there's more than one of these gods out there. I mean, I think the line is, mankind was made in, we made God, man in our image. I think that's right. I'm not 100%. I mean, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, sure. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and
I think it's Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image." That's it.
And so you're dealing with some sort of, you know, it seems like you're dealing with more than one of these. I think, you know, when you're dealing with the Noah story of the Bible, you know, basically God just wanted to start over. He just wants to wipe out mankind and anything that mankind had laid their fingers on, which would, of course, been this knowledge that Enoch brought back from his, you know, heavenly visit, if you will. You know, this gets into really deep concepts of, you know, is this God, you know, quote unquote figure, you know, is this a positive thing or a negative thing? I mean, you know, why does he want to wipe this out? You know, why does he want to, you know, eradicate mankind?
Yeah.
You know, this gets into deeper questions regarding, you know, I know the person who really, you know, one of the 19th century people who kind of turned this on its head almost was Madame Blavatsky, you know, who kind of thought, you know, that the serpent, you know, in the tree was the sort of the wisdom bringer and the good guy, which of course goes completely against Orthodox Christianity.
Yep.
And that the God figure was sort of, you know, and this kind of gets into like what we were talking about with Enoch, is sort of the negative, you know, what's the word, the demiurge, you know, the negative artisan type of deity who just, for lack of a better word, just wants to mess around with mankind.
Well, this concept as well of trying to keep mankind in a state of maybe not ignorance per se, but of not knowing. It's that, you know, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. That's the problem in a way, that there's a drive in mankind to know some of these answers. And at the same time, it seems like the deity, God, just wanted to create a safe playpen for mankind, what I mean.
Yeah, that's sort of the whole concept of the demiurge. You know, it's this sort of lesser god who just wants to, like, you know, mess around with, like you said, just basically treat man like it's a playground or a sandlot, basically. You know, just kind of, you know, toy around with him, if you will.
That's right. Well, very interesting ideas. We're going to continue talking more about this, of course, with Robert Sullivan. Why don't we give out some of your details, Robert? Want to mention the book title once again and the websites where people can go to get a copy. I think you have a couple of Facebook pages out there as well. Please give out the details.
Sure. My website is www.robertwsullivaniv.com. If you go to my website, there's links to buy the book. I have a Twitter feed, which is at RWS4TH. I have two Facebook pages, one for The Royal Arch of Enoch. That's my current book. Its full title is The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. That's out right now. That's on Kindle, Nook, you know, iPhone, iTunes. You know, you can buy that everywhere. It's also in hard paperback. You can get that off of my publisher's website, which is directly linked to my website. You can get it off of Amazon.com if you want. My other, and its Facebook page is facebook.com/ The Royal Arch of Enoch, all lowercase, all one word. The other Facebook page is my current book that I'm working on called Cinema Symbolism. That's facebook.com /cinema symbolism. That's all lowercase, all connected, no dashes or anything like that. You can go to my website. There's information there about me. There's information about how to buy the book. You can read a little chapter excerpt if you want. I have an events and appearance pages, which is constantly updated. If you have a question you want to ask me, I have a direct link to my email where you can just click on it. If you want to drop me a line, feel free. And my page again is www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
Very good. We'll have the link up on redicecreations.com, and the book is called The Royal Arch of Enoch. Much more to come, so stay with us, Robert. We'll return after a short break here.
Sunshine, go away today. I don't feel much like dancing. Some man's gone, he's tried to run my life. He don't know what he's asking. When he tells me I better get in line, I can't hear what he's saying. When I grow up, I'm gonna make it mine. These ain't dues I've been paying. Well, how much does it cost? I'll buy it. The time is all we've lost. I'll try it. And he can't even run his own life. I'll be damned if you run mine. Sunshine, sunshine, go away today. I don't feel much like dancing. Some man's gone, he's tried to run my life. He don't know what he's asking. Working starts to make me wonder where the fruits of what I do are going. He says in love and war all is fair, but he's got cards he ain't showing. Well, how much does it cost? I'll buy it. The time is all we've lost. I'll try it. And he can't even run his own life. I'll be damned if run mine. Sunshine, sunshine, come on back another day. I promise you I'll be singing. This old world, she's gonna turn around. Brand new bells will be